when we identify a problem, we say, okay, here's the thing that's going to fix it. We're going to start you on this medication, right? Okay. Or you're going to be referred to the surgeon who's going to take the thing out. But there is this excruciating part of transplant, which is we've identified the thing that's going to help your child, your loved one, but you have to wait. And we have no ability to tell you when that new organ may become available. It's a process. It's hard for folks to wrap their mind around. I do think that live donation is such a massive benefit in the liver and kidney world because it allows families to, in many cases, minimize the wait.
Welcome to the Living Transplant Podcast, where we take you behind the scenes at the Ajmera Transplant Center at Toronto General Hospital, Canada's largest and most comprehensive transplant program, performing over 700 transplants annually. I'm your host, Candice. Each episode, we share the powerful stories from transplant recipients and living donors, along with insights and education from leading medical professionals. Today on the podcast, we're joined by Dr. Blaine Syed, a surgeon and scientist at the forefront of liver and pediatric transplantation. Dr. Syed is a faculty member in the Department of Surgery at the University of Toronto, an associate scientist at SickKids Research Institute, and a liver transplant and HPB surgeon at SickKids and Toronto General Hospital, where he serves as the surgical lead for pediatric liver transplant. Did you know that when a child needs a liver donor, both the adult liver donor evaluation and surgery take place at UHN? A powerful reflection of our strong partnership. At the heart of Dr. Syed's work is a deep commitment to his patients with a simple but powerful goal, helping children receive one liver and keep it for their entire lives. His research explores how liver injury and cell death shape the liver's immune system, advancing our understanding of immune memory and opening new possibilities for improving long-term transplant outcomes for children. This is one you're not going to want to miss. Please enjoy. Welcome back to the Living Transplant Podcast. Thank you so much, Dr. Syed, for joining me here today. I'm really excited to chat with you.
It's my pleasure. Really glad to be here.
So we're going to jump right in. I'm wondering if you can tell me a little bit about being a surgeon at SickKids, what some of those technical challenges of pediatric liver surgery are that most people wouldn't understand.
Yeah, so I mean, I can give you a little bit of background about my role in the team. So basically, I kind of have multiple jobs, as many people in academic medicine do. So I am at SickKids as the surgical head of our transplant and hepatobiliary surgery program there. And then I'm also at UHN at Toronto General Hospital as part of the liver transplant and live donor team. And then also have a basic science research laboratory in the SickKids Research Institute. In terms of SickKids, it's a wonderful institution. I mean, I think from a purely Canadian pride perspective, I really it's hard to articulate just how outstanding our institutions are. Both SickKids and Toronto Generals are world-class hospitals, as we all know, truly amazing institutions that take amazing care of our patients. SickKids is a very busy program. We're one of the top two pediatric transplant centers in North America from an annual volume perspective, basically every year. And we deal with very complicated patients. We get patients sent to us from all over the country who may not be transplant candidates at other programs. And so we're always dealing with technically challenging, complicated patients. I would say first and foremost, one of the more technically challenging things, or one of the more challenging things, is deciding who's a candidate and who's not. Saying that somebody's not a transplant candidate, which is fairly rare, we understand the weight that that carries. That being said, we obviously want to make the best medical decision for that patient, but it's complicated. And so I would say that's the first and foremost. One of the challenges is dealing with complicated patients, some of whom have intrinsic liver disease, some of whom have tumors, some of whom have had some type of surgical mishap at somewhere else, and having to deal with the consequences of that. You know, from a surgical perspective, the technical challenges are oftentimes quite different than in adults. The vessels that we work with, are tiny. We recently transplanted a baby who was 3-point-something kilos.
Oh my goodness.
So just trying to find the liver for that patient.
Wow.
Does it fit? Is this the right size? And then just all the technical challenges that come along with the complicated vascular reconstruction, making sure that we don't squeeze things in too tightly, et cetera. And then the recovery process afterwards, for sure. They oftentimes are in the ICU, particularly for our smallest babies, for a period of time while they recover post-transplant. Certainly from a surgical, but from like a personal perspective, it's stressful. It's very stressful making those decisions and being in those situations. And so trying to manage your own emotions as well as the stress and the emotions of your team certainly takes some time and effort.
Yeah, at the weight of that, you know, you're not just working on one person, you're working on an entire family when you're in that surgical room with that Yes. little baby or that child that you're working with.
100%, right? And our tolerance for failure is very low, right? I mean, and we always have this conversation with certainly adult patients and their families, but the families right. of pediatric patients as well, that we say, listen, nothing in medicine is 0% or 100%.
Yeah.
If I promise you 0% or 100% of something, I'm not being honest. But the stress, exactly like you were saying, when you enter that operating room, the stress of knowing you have someone's entire world in your hands, like it's quite stressful. And so knowing how to, you know, manage that for yourself, how to block some of that out, how to help manage it for the team. It's certainly something that we think about and have to kind of practice, because it can be quite as wonderful and joyful as it can be and is on a daily basis. It's all going to be quite heavy and challenging.
And so, you know, when there's that high stakes, do you feel like it's also like on the other side, when it does go really, really well, do you feel like it's, you know, those Super Bowl moments that you get so many more are of those really large celebrations and, you know, having that really big peak of highs and lows throughout these surgeries of, you know, that's such high risk, but then such high reward as well?
So the short answer is yes. I think a lot of surgeons are super paranoid. Like we're like, you know, sometimes like after the surgery, you're updating the family. Listen, everything went well and everybody, you know, and everyone's like thanking. And I'm like, do not thank me until we're discharged. Like we're not, no thanking. We can give hugs. But like, because you're so paranoid and yeah, you're so cautious and you know, you've seen when things can go wrong and when you're not expecting or so on and so forth. So we're all a little bit paranoid about that. So I think that's one element. But I do think more than anything, the relationships that we establish longitudinally, because we follow patients for so long. And, you know, unlike the adult population where it's just a lot more patients, the volume is higher on the pediatric in the pediatric side, it's not as many patients. They tend to have longer courses. They're admitted for us for longer. When you have a baby who's struggling nutritionally, prior to transplant, they're going to be admitted for a month. We're going to do the transplant. Then they're going to be admitted for a month or 6 weeks afterwards. So that's a lot of time with those families. And so we know them quite well. So what I would say is that those moments of celebration, although you may not necessarily have the peak highs, we have this kind of longitudinal relationship. And I think, you know, with one of the families we'll talk about today, it's exactly that. They come to know you pretty well and you them. And it's almost like the child becomes a bit part of your family and you a part of theirs, which is a really special thing. And I think that happens with some frequency with the kids that we take care of.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So thinking about that, you know, we're going to be talking to Joseph and Bianca, whose daughter had a liver transplant from Joseph, the dad. And you know, we talked a little bit about that already shortly about the family system and, you know, how those family dynamics really shape decision making, recovery. You know, this is a lifelong journey now. You have a small child and then eventually they're going to become a teenager and may not want to listen to you. How do all of those family dynamics come into play and really shape that, you know, 0 to 18-year journey that these patients go through with you?
Yeah, it's a great question. And there's a lot of facets to that answer. You know, I think for families, let's talk about families who have very young children, you know, children like, so our most common indication for transplant in the pediatric world is some type of what we call cholestatic liver disease. So basically where the bile ducts don't drain the liver effectively. The most common of those is biliary atresia, where there is basically children are born without a normal bile duct system. You know, in those cases, it's quite a journey for the parents because they learn of the diagnosis usually within the first, you know, month to 6 weeks of their child's birth. The baby becomes jaundiced. They know something's not right after the first few weeks. They get worked up. There is a temporizing surgical procedure that they may undergo called a Kasai procedure, which helps to try to drain. They, in essence, all will fail at some point. The goal is just to get some drainage so the child can grow and get bigger before needing transplant. In some occasions, they may get to teenage years or to young adulthood, but they in essence will all fail. So there's this kind of like very profound diagnosis, knowing that your child has a real problem. By the time, even from an early kind of Kasai failure, maybe they're 8 months old, 9 months old, right? And already for the entire 9 months, the family's been in and out of hospital, constant liaising and seeing the medical system. So they're already at that point. Then they go through this process where they're really kind of having to wrap their mind around transplant. Well, how are we going to get my child, my baby transplanted? Is someone going to be able to donate in the family for a live donor? It's about 70% of the transplants we do with sick kids are from live donors. So there's that whole process. It's quite challenging. For the babies themselves, obviously, they don't know any different at that age. But the parents, really, it can be very stressful to families, to the parents, to the extended family. Many of them have other children at home. How do you balance that, right? Like, it's so challenging, totally human feelings and behavior. But we have to kind of, you know, we deal with that. Helping the parents navigate this, like the marathon that it is. We have wonderful social workers and child support health. We've had some really profound gifts. The Team Izzy Foundation has one of our transplant recipients really committed to our program. And one of the things we've been able to do is get a psychologist who works with our patients and families. And we really want to kind of actually extend this to all of our solid organ transplant programs at SickKids. Because it is, it's a very real thing, the stress that goes along with that. There's economic stress. What if you have a single parent who's the sole earner for their family? We have families who don't have a lot of other family, extended family here in Canada, right? Like, so there's just so many stressors with that. It can be quite complicated. On the, you know, flip side, the wonderful thing is after transplant, our kids tend to do very, very well. And so seeing them as they grow, exactly like you were saying with Joseph and Bianca's daughter, like seeing them and how she grows and like is doing so well, it's really thrilling and it's great to see. But there's always a stress. So like I always tell parents, like the further you get from transplant, the more comfortable you'll be. But certainly in the early times, you're always waiting for the other shoe to drop, right? Like, oh, they have a fever. Is there a problem, right? It may just be that they got a viral infection and a runny nose, but there's all this like the layers of concern that, you know, we all saw our parents feel for us or we feel for our own kids. You know, it's like that magnified, multiplied by factors, right? So they deal with that throughout childhood. And I think the more comfortable parents and kids are afterwards, the more time they have, then the more comfortable they get. They know what's going on. They understand this is a cold or there's something else. You get more comfortable in that and being that advocate for your child and understanding that. The teenage years are a particular challenge, and I think that we as a transplant community have work to do there. The transition from teenage years to young adulthood, like you mentioned, is a challenge, right? People, there's a natural process of rebellion, understanding autonomy, selfhood, personhood, and all of those things. I went through a very rough time when I was a teenager and I was wild. And
as did I.
Wanted to kick
we
you,
don't do that
you
know? For the podcast,
exactly.
Right?
Yeah. Exactly. It's a whole separate podcast. Don't get my parents on here. But you go through that unrelated to anything to do with your health,
right.
Disease, anything else. How do you, you know, sometimes kids just don't want to think of themselves as different. They want to fit in. And they're... Yeah. Medical journey up until that point has been something that's always marked them as different. Mm-hmm. And they don't want to think about taking their immunosuppression. They don't want to think about, you know, I should or shouldn't do this. My friends are doing this. Right. So it can be very, very challenging. And I think we are still, you know, we in the medical field sometimes fall back very easily on these tropes that aren't helpful. Oh, this is a compliant or a non-compliant patient. Not helpful. Not helpful. Doesn't help our patients. Doesn't help us. We understanding that psychology, understanding how to best transition. So there's something we're certainly working on the sick kid side is building a more comprehensive transition program starting earlier so that we start to transition some of that autonomy and then really having a bridge to this side of the street on the UHN side so that we have partners that we work with on a bit of a regular basis. Because it's not just for liver transplant patients, it's for kidney transplant patients, for heart transplant patients, for lung transplant patients, bowel transplant patients, right? That we're bridging into the adult world because that's also a big abrupt break for them. As much as they may want to rebel against it, all of a sudden their doctors that they've known for 15, 16, 18 years are different doctors. And they it's a totally different and different coordinators and different nurses and different nurse practitioners. And so making that transition. So we're trying to start a little bit earlier. We have a bit of a bridge between the programs because we really collaborate well together in many different things clinically. But that's something I think where we need some growth because the last thing we want to be doing is retransplanting these children in their young adulthoods because we are struggling with issues of taking meds and dealing with some of the adult decisions and autonomy.
Yeah, and it's interesting. I mean, you know, talking to some of the kids that I know, I've known their parents for years and, you know, watching them go from, like you said, like little 8-year-olds to now one of them is in university. And, you know, one of the things that she said was it felt like a hospital. The gift shop was terrible and there were grown-ups everywhere, right? And so like in our heads, we think, oh, probably the hardest thing will be, you know, actually taking the pill instead of having a liquid or, you know, learning your new doctor's names. But to her, it was like very visual cues and safety and, you know, things like that, that it was like, I don't feel as safe in this hospital because it's cold in here. There's no like flying pigs. There's no colors. Like it's a very clinical space now. Even the gift shop looks different, right? So it's interesting to hear from kids what, you know, the big differences are and how do we help them manage that so that they don't feel alone going through this. Like thinking about the family system as a whole and how do we make sure parents are comfortable with it? It's outside of even the medical piece of it.
Yeah. I mean, it's challenging enough to parent teenagers in general. Yes. Like when you have all these extra layers of worry and concern, like it's even more, right? It's quite difficult. And so I can't even get my kids to brush their teeth, you know, like sometimes like that's how you feel. It's like, how the heck am I going to get them to, you know, schedule appointments or take like, and for the young people, exactly like you said, for the teenagers, the young adults, as they go through this process, sometimes it's not just about the medication. It's about the feeling of I don't want to be a patient anymore. Yes. This feels like I've been a patient my entire life, right? Like it's been held me back from this, that, or the other. That's the feeling, the perception. And so exactly when they transition to an adult environment, sometimes it's a bit more challenging because it feels more clinical and less, you know, less personal. So
yeah, absolutely. And I mean, even for me, I was like a young adult in my 20s, but even that thought of, you know, being othered or feeling like you're different than your peers is huge in those transitional times, like being in university, doing dialysis or, you know, going to somebody's birthday party and thinking about the shirt I have to wear to cover up my dialysis catheters, like those types of things that they're not in the Epic charts. They're not in, you know, our pamphlets of how to deal with people. It's kind of a, you know, you learn as you go and you try to support them as much as you can. Right. But yeah. And you're right. I have a 4-year-old and, you know, sometimes just getting her snow pants on and getting her out the door is the hardest thing. Right. So no, all of these additional challenges that these parents go through, it's quite remarkable that they do it. Now, going into the research side of things, I know you do a lot of research as to, you know, a lot of our docs do. And with your research on liver injury and cell death in the liver and how that primes the liver immune system in transplant and liver disease, can you explain to us a little bit about what that is and why understanding the immune system is a critical frontier in improving long-term transplant outcomes for kids?
You know, hand in hand with anything that we do in academic medicine is this emphasis on research, right? And because on the clinical side, there will always be need. But the question is, how do we do it better? How do we do this better? How do we do from a transplantation perspective, from a preventing transplant perspective? Like, I think the goal for many people who are in clinical medicine is, could I find a way to put myself out of business, right? Like to obviate the need for my job. And the way to do that is really from a research perspective is having better outcomes for our patients, for adult and pediatric patients. Our understanding of the liver immune system is growing. We certainly have worldwide experts here at UHN. Dr. Sonia McParland is a great example of that. And we're building a core group of folks at SickKids in our research institute, myself included, who have a primary interest in liver disease and liver injury. My lab is in the cell and systems biology program at the research institute, and we collaborate a lot with folks in the Department of Immunology, departments of physiology, and certainly collaborations between the SickKids Research Institute and the UHN and the TGH Research Institute. Our focus really is understanding, the way that cells die is actually really incredibly important. And so cell death happens all the time. As you imagine, in anybody's body, there are actually millions of cells dying at kind of any given time as part of normal homeostasis and turnover of cells. We know it happens, obviously, in highly exposed, the mucosa, the skin, places like that, but it's happening all the time. The way that those cells die is through a programmed type of cell death that is, in essence, kind of immunologically inert. It doesn't raise any alarm bells. It doesn't prime our immune system. It's just kind of a normal collapse of the cell, clearance by cells that kind of clear up dead cells and debris, and then you have normal tissue regeneration. That's kind of a typical, in a normal homeostatic baseline setting for humans. When we have injury, if that's trauma, if that's a burn, if that is an insult to an organ, some type of toxic insult, cells die in different ways. And they tend to die in ways that are actually not inert. They die in ways that basically they, in essence, spill some of their intracellular components outside. And those are danger signals to the body. And it makes sense that that's the way that it is. In essence, when you have an infection in your body, you can imagine, or a trauma in your body and cells are injured, the body wants to know that it's happening. And the spillage of things that are supposed to be inside the cell outside is a signal to the body that something's not right. And so those are very kind of strong inflammatory signals. And so it sends in a bunch of immune cells to that area to kind of figure out what's going on. That creates inflammation, sometimes a little bit more helpful sometimes a little bit more harmful than helpful. And so it can really prime the immune response. In the context of transplantation, we're taking an organ from one person and bringing it into another person, right? And there is intrinsically to that some harm to the organ. It comes out of a body. It's deprived of oxygen and all the kind of critical nutrients and metabolites that it needs. We have ways to try to minimize that injury, certain preservation fluids. There's stuff going on now with, ex vivo pumps, or pumping organs. We've been doing this for years in kidney with the cold pump, but now moving into the liver field and the lung field with these ex vivo pumps to try to minimize that injury, but it still occurs. Hand in hand with that is, and what drives the injury is cell death. It's cells dying when they're deprived of those nutrients. And so what we're really focused on is understanding if there are ways. It's hard to prevent the cell from dying, but it is possible to change the way that it dies, to shift it from this like pro-inflammatory type of cell death to make it mimic a cell death that's this normal inert cell death. And that doesn't prime the immune system in the same way. And so that's what we've been working on, in particular in liver disease. And so our models have, we work with models of disease, we work with human tissue and understanding some of those pathways. I think for children, it's of critical importance because our goal, of course, is like we want kids to have one transplant in their lifetime. And if we can modify the amount of injury to their new liver when it comes in, or if they're experiencing some type of rejection crisis or some type of infection, if we can also treat that in a way that kind of modifies that immune response, it's super important. We know that immunologic memory sticks around for a long period of time. And so if you have a liver from one person into the recipient, anytime that we spill cells, it has the possibility of priming the recipient to have a response against their new organ, right? Because it is different. It's self and non-self. And so the goal is to minimize the amount of spilling and tissue damage so that we can minimize the amount of that immune response against the organ itself. And so that's basically what we're working on. The medications that we use in transplant, we've been using for decades, most of them, right? And so, as you know, some of them are, you know, they're better variations. We understand how to give it better, but they're, you know, fairly similar. There's a lot going on in immune biology, I think, in cancer biology now with these checkpoint inhibitors. There's a ton of really interesting, fascinating stuff where we're basically using the body's immune system to kill cancers, right? Which is a super exciting, it's not a toxic kind of chemotherapy in the way that many other chemotherapies are. Transplant is the flip side of the same coin, right? We'd actually like to do the opposite thing. We'd like to prevent the body's immune system from harming the new organ. And so all of these new mechanisms that we're kind of discovering and getting better sense of, we can actually use a lot of that science and technology. The problem is the transplant community is much smaller than the cancer community. The cancer community like exceeds by leaps and bounds. And so we have to be able to kind of generate the focus and the interest. And so that's part of our goal there is not for the immunotherapies, but to say like there are treatment methods, there are treatment modalities, therapeutic pathways that we have yet to explore within the field of transplant, liver transplant, transplant immunology, you know, liver injury, liver biology, that are actually could be very rich and could actually really help our armamentarium for transplant patients, because it would be great to have new medications, less toxic medications, as you well know, for folks who've had a transplant so they don't have to deal with those side effects for the rest of their lives.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's fascinating stuff, thinking about, you know, using the opposite technology to what's happening in that cancer field. And, you know, thinking about children having that one organ their entire life being the goal, of course. You know, often when we're transplanted, we're told this is a replacement therapy. You know, you may not have this the rest of your life. So, you know, take really good care of it so we can keep it as long as we can. But I think especially too in the kidney field, we assume we're going to need another organ. That's just an assumption that we make on that side of things. And thinking about immunosuppressants and being a patient that takes them several times a day, every day, I think that's often, you know, a top priority. And a lot of the patients that I talk to is, you know, would there be a day someday where, you know, children may not need to take immunosuppressants, or at least it's tapered to a place where, you know, it's not that they're not as many side effects, or it's not as invasive to them. And, you know, sometimes I think we think that science takes so incredibly long to change things. But, you know, looking at what's happened in the transplant field, even in the last 20 years, in my view, you know, it's leaps and bounds, and it's going very quickly. And thinking about those immunosuppressants, do you think that is in the near future of seeing kids who may not need lifelong immunosuppressants?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, the interesting thing, certainly from a liver transplant perspective, is amongst all the organs that we transplant, like we as a field, heart, lungs, liver, kidneys, intestines, the pancreas, the liver actually needs kind of the least amount of immunosuppression. We call it a very tolerogenic organ. There's a few different theories and reasons for that we won't get into, but, you know, many patients post-liver transplant, pediatric and adult, need actually a relatively low amount of immunosuppression long-term. After they get out of that kind of initial period post-transplant, as things kind of settle in, the body and the new organ settle into their rhythm, they need actually not that much. There was certainly data in the early 2000s, there was a lot of push towards withdrawal trials to see if we could kind of identify who didn't need immunosuppression. And what, depending on the data that you see, it was kind of anywhere from 15 to 30% of a relatively highly selected group to start with of post-liver transplant patients. This is in the pediatric field, but some of this mimicked in the adult world. But around 15 to 30% of patients didn't need really immunosuppression. They could be, in essence, become functionally tolerant of their new liver. The problem that we have is, how do we identify those folks? Because if we just stop everybody's immunosuppression, it may benefit those 1/6 to 1/3 of people, but right, everybody else is going to develop rejection, and that could, right, be really threatening to their organ and have some real complications. So I do think that the ability to develop either better clinical algorithms to really narrow the pool of who we're potentially stopping immunosuppression in, so to raise the success rate when we do stop, that's one, but also to find a biomarker, to find key signals of who is probably going to do well with minimization or stopping of immunosuppression versus those, mm-hmm, who won't,
right,
it is actually a very achievable goal. It doesn't require new therapy. That's the nice thing. And it doesn't, mm-hmm, require a ton of like pharma investment and something. Actually, right, probably not, right? It just requires better understanding and some biomarkers, which I think people have been working on. So it's been a bit of an elusive goal for some years, but I do think that's something that's very achievable in our lifetimes, understanding how to do that. And then understanding if there are specific immune markers in particular, can they go across pediatrics to adults? Can they go across organ systems, not just for liver, but also for kidney, so on and so forth? The frustrating thing, and I'm sure you know, and we feel this on the kidney side in particular, is the same medication that saves your kidney is also the one that injures it, right? And
yes,
so having some better approach there. And there's certainly, we know, I mean, this is how the field of transplant got started, right? The story in Boston with Joe Murray, who was the surgeon, and the Herrick twins who had their transplant. They were biologic twins, right? They were identical twins. And so there's always, in essence, and that was our first successful, in essence, live donor kidney transplant that worked very well. In that case, we didn't solve the biology. We just bypassed it. But it showed it's not the technical part. It's not the clinical technical part. It's the biology and the immunology behind it. And so I think we've always, we have a few, patients, pediatric and adult, who have needed both a liver transplant and a bone marrow transplant, right, for their disease biology. When we have the same donor for those, we know we can stop their immunosuppression, right? Because their immune system becomes what we call chimeric, right? It becomes the same. So that's fantastic. So we know that we are able to bypass it. There have been a few clinical trials with actually bone marrow transplant in kidney transplant recipients specifically for this reason, mm-hmm, but it's a pretty heavy therapy, right? Just
right,
for,
yeah,
tolerance for the kidney. So, we know we have ways around it. The ideal would be finding ways to better identify patients who we can withdraw or minimize immunosuppression, and then figuring out if we can kind of get patients towards that, and so that we have a more successful ability to stop immunosuppression. Certainly in the liver field, I think it's an achievable goal.
I think anybody listening would be celebrating about that achievable goal for sure, because I think that would be a huge success and a huge piece to it, right? That would be,
yes,
incredible. Yeah. And especially thinking about a child, right? We want those kids to grow up in the healthiest possible way they can, right? So if they could have a full life with a new liver without immunosuppressants, that would just be, the gold standard, I would think. Yeah. Amazing. These ones aren't necessarily scientific, but, thinking about the families that you meet, if you could have time to talk to them and tell them something as they're waiting for that organ, is there something, from your perspective, either, as the surgeon or a researcher or even a dad, that you would want to tell these families about the wait for the organ?
This is a really kind of unique and somewhat excruciating part of transplant, right? Like, it's hard. Like most other types of medicine, surgery, when we identify a problem, we say, okay, here's the thing that's going to fix it. We're going to start you on this medication, right? Okay. Or you're going to be referred to the surgeon who's going to take the thing out. But there is this excruciating part of transplant, which is we've identified the thing that's going to help your child, your loved one, but you have to wait. And we have no ability to tell you when that new organ may become available. And not all solid organ transplant. Kidney's a little bit of an exception, but in many of them, liver, heart, we also say your loved one's going to have to get sicker before they get prioritized to get an organ. So that's a really difficult thing to tell families, right? There's this, they've already, and like we talked about before, many of them on the pediatric side have already been in this process for months. And so to say your child needs a transplant and family's like, great, that's going to happen next week, you know, and you're like,
Right.
So it's a process. It's hard for folks to wrap their mind around. I do think that live donation is such a massive benefit in the liver and kidney world because it allows families to, in many cases, minimize or skip or avoid the wait. And so they don't have to see their loved one get sicker and sicker. The hardest thing we have to deal with sometimes with families is when somebody who wants to donate can't be a donor. It's very difficult. It's hard to tell them that. There are medical reasons. You know, when we actually just yesterday, someone was just telling me this. I didn't realize this. Dr. Selzer was telling me this. That was our 1400th live donor liver transplant yesterday.
Wow.
Which is a remarkable accomplishment. It speaks to the achievements of certainly, you know, Dr. Selzner on the medical side, Dr. Grant and Cattrall and Dr. Gregg, former members of the program who really built it up, Dr. Ganikar, who runs the program now, all the members of this program who have done all that work. But it's one of the biggest in the Western world, if not the biggest in the Western world, certainly in North America. It's a huge program. And in that 1,400, that includes pediatric patients as well. We're going to hit 800 pediatric liver transplants. That's the kids fairly soon. So a big chunk of those have been live donors. It's been a lifeline to so many patients, but not just patients, to families, right? Like, it's given them more time with their loved ones. It's created bonds between family members. And so sometimes it can be very, very difficult for parents to hear, loved ones hear, that they can't be a donor. That's always a challenge. So that's something I always try to counsel parents on before, is to say, listen, here are the statistics. Not everybody who wants to donate can donate medically, anatomically, size of the liver, things like that, for smaller children, and to counsel them that, you know, this is a process, that your health or the health of the donor when it comes to live donation is paramount, that we don't make any exceptions there, because it wouldn't just affect that individual, but it would affect our program, right? If we had a donor, serious donor complication, it could shut things down, right, while we try to deal with that. And so it's not just about this one case, but it's about these other 1,400 people that have been transplanted right in that process. So, you know, that's one of the challenges. And then, you know, really understanding that it's, again, it's a marathon. It's not a sprint. And it's hard. It's hard for those families. There's no easy way around it. I think knowing that, one thing I always like to do is both sides of the street, but certainly on the pediatric side, is I just pop in to see families, you know, to say hi. I know they're waiting, you know, that they know that the limiting factor is not our availability. Our team is there. We're there to care for their loved one. We're there to care for their child and to take care of them as a family, and that we're there and present. And I think they take some solace in that, but it's not easy. It's quite difficult. And there's no easy way to kind of work around that besides having kind of a relationship and trust in the team and knowing that we're putting your loved one first and really trying our best to get your child transplanted.
Well, I can say from, you know, the patients that I know and the people who I've talked to, when I said I was recording this episode, there are a couple families, you know, who said, oh, you know, he has been just a saint to us and such a gift in our lives. And you mentioned popping in to see the families, and you mentioned it so casually. But I have so many patients who have said, like, I don't think he understands the weight of his pop-ins and how good it made us feel and how comforted it made us feel that he actually cared. And so, you know, just as a side, I hope you know, the impact and the difference that you're making for patients when you do things like that, because it, you know, we can feel like our doctors are sometimes these scary big people, especially to little kids. And, you know, if you know, we have some fears of the healthcare system. So knowing that there are people that, you know, have that kindness in them and actually care is really amazing. But before we go, I always like to ask, you know, we've talked a little bit about this, but is there something that you are really hopeful for and that really interests you? You know, we've heard a little bit about your research and other things, but is there something you're really hopeful for or excited about with changes and innovation coming to the future of pediatric transplant for people?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think transplant's in a really interesting moment right now, liver transplant certainly in particular, but not exclusively. There are some things happening with the way that we perfuse organs, like we just mentioned briefly before. But in essence, you know, that we have systems now that are capable of preserving, you know, livers outside the body for a longer period of time. And the nice thing with these systems is they certainly minimize the injury to the new organs, which actually has real clinical effects. When someone gets a liver that's been injured because of the recovery process, it has a clinical effect on them. It can hurt the kidneys. It can hurt the new liver. It can in the ICU for a longer period of time. This is both pediatric and adult patients. I think we haven't even touched the tip of the iceberg in understanding, wait a second, like we have these systems, these machines that we can put the liver outside the body, can we use it to actually change the function of the organ, right? So like, can we use it to, you know, the medications and the things that I was talking about with cell death? Well, that's when it would start. Like, can we actually treat the liver on the pump before it even goes into somebody's body, minimize the inflammation in that liver and the damage there, and then we put it into the patient, and then they're getting a better liver, and actually they don't even get exposed to this new medication, right? Because it's mostly on the pump and right. It would wash out, right? So I think there's a lot of different things that we are going to be able to, right now we're using these ex vivo pumps as the therapy itself. I think one of the exciting things, which is great, it's moved us a lot, and particularly not so much yet in the pediatric world. I think that will come a little bit. Mm-hmm. In the adult world, it's helped us to take livers that aren't perfect livers and make them safe for transplant.
Right.
Which is great, right? Because we have this gap of the number of people listed and the number of organs available. So it's helped us to narrow that gap by saying, okay, here's some organs that wouldn't be otherwise usable, but they're actually now with this, it's helping them to become better. So it's narrowing the gap. But I think we have yet, I'm very excited about this idea that we can, instead of those machines being the destination therapy, that they're just a vehicle for the new therapies that we can potentially use while on the pump, ways of evaluating the liver function, ways of treating the new organ, ways of minimizing the damage without having the patients undergo that. So I think that's a big part. Like all things, I think this is actually, you know, one of the things you asked me about before was the technical challenges for pediatric liver transplant. Mm-hmm. One of the challenges we have, like, these are some of the most technically challenging cases that we do, right? Like, because of the size of the vessels, they're very small, everything else. One of the challenges that we have actually is, part of the challenge is that we don't have large numbers. Meaning, like, so it's a very highly technical field, but you're not transplanting 3 kilo babies on a daily basis the way that you might be transplanting an adult on a daily basis, right? This is a very infrequent thing, right? And so it ends up being a very small group of folks doing this. Mm-hmm. And so in that context, it's a really challenging field to gain expertise, to, you know, to do all of these things. So there is this challenge of volume in the pediatric field. Mm-hmm. Outside of the technical aspects of that, the other challenge with that is, do research and technology firms, do pharma firms really want to get into involved in pediatrics? And the answer oftentimes is no.
Right.
Because it doesn't generate a lot of income, right? Like, you want to, you know, it doesn't generate the revenue that many. So we are, in essence, on the pediatric side, always a little bit of an afterthought to the adult world. So something gets rolled out in the adults first, and then pediatric people advocating for them say, can we try to use this? And so we have to get either compassionate use, or we get the, you know, the manufacturers to kind of open up so that it's not restricted against pediatric patients. I think one of the benefits is, as a lot of this stuff has been rolled out in the adult world, is us understanding, hey, we can use this in pediatrics as well. Like, yes, the manufacturer's initial instructions were X, Y, and Z, and it excluded pediatric patients, but it's not because it doesn't work for pediatric transplant patients. It's just because that was, in essence, how things were rolled out and tested and started. So I think a lot of the stuff that we see with perfusion technologies, with some of the new therapeutics that are hopefully coming down the line, are going to be rolled out on the pediatric side because there's certainly real applicability, and we have enough safety data in the adult world now, because we're generating enough of experience that some of these things are going to trickle down to the pediatric side, which is really great, right? And that's what we want, is that, like, exactly that. Our pediatric patients aren't just an afterthought, that we're really thinking about them first. And so, right, now that we have some of this safety data and applicability data, that we can start to, you know, ex vivo normothermic perfusion technologies, normothermic regional perfusion techniques and approaches, and really making transplant better, liver transplant and other transplant for our pediatric patients. And so I'm really actually excited about that in the next 5 to 10 years. I think a lot of this is going to be applied in the pediatric world with real benefit.
Amazing. That's fascinating. And I feel like I could keep you on here for another 2 hours and, you know, have a lot more questions. But thank you so much for taking the time with us today. It's been wonderful asking questions and getting to hear from you. And I'm sure a lot of our listeners are going to be fascinated to hear what's coming. So thank you for all you do. And thank you for being on today.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of the Living Transplant Podcast. If you did, please rate, leave us a review, and share with your friends. Don't forget to subscribe to Living Transplant wherever you're listening today. If you have any ideas for podcast episodes, please reach out to us at livingorgandonation@uhn.ca. For information about living organ donation, you can visit us at www.livingorgandonation.ca. Special thanks to Bespoke Productions for editing this episode and for production support. I'm your host, Candace Coughlin. Thanks for spending your time with us.